You're listening to Square One, a podcast where we interview the best in business and innovation. I'm Alex Ranzi, and for episode 20, I had the honor to interview Eric Voorhees. Eric Voorhees is a name synonymous with Bitcoin and crypto assets. Among Bitcoin's earliest adopters, Eric's passion led him to found multiple successful companies, among them Satoshi Dice, one of the first scaled Bitcoin applications, and Shapeshift, a leading crypto asset exchange. Eric is also one of crypto's true visionaries, which is why I was so excited to chat with him for episode 20 of Square One. Eric and I discussed some exciting projects on the horizon, including privacy coins and salt lending, community governance issues that came to light through Eric's advocacy for Bitcoin SegWit and increased block size, regulatory pressure and community self-governing solutions, and much more.
So Eric, thank you for joining us for the Square One podcast.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Would love to kick it off by hearing a little bit, and just for the sake of getting the listeners up to speed, about your early experience with crypto, how you got into Bitcoin, you know, and the various ventures that you've run along the way.
Yeah. Well, I guess I'm one of the OGs in the crypto world. So I got involved in 2011, early May of 2011, back when the price was about $5, and just before the first bubble that went up to $31 and then crashed over the next 9 months down to $2. And basically I just saw a Facebook post about it, and I got a little intrigued. And after reading a few articles, my initial skepticism was fairly washed away. And I thought this is probably going to be the, you know, one of those things that changes the world. And
yep,
it was inevitable. Basically the ability to move money anywhere in the world for free without anyone being able to stop you seemed like something that was inevitable to me. And ever since then, I've just been, you know, down the rabbit hole and trying to help grow that into something that went from, you know, theoretically possible to something that actually ended up changing the world.
What were some of the things that you learned when you were first digging in that gave you that conviction, given there's still, you know, an incredible amount of skepticism out there?
Yeah, it was one thing in particular, which was that Bitcoin wasn't a company and didn't have a center. So it didn't have a central server. It didn't have any company or person behind it. It was an open source protocol. And because of that attribute, it couldn't be shut down. So I had known about projects like eGold a few years prior, which was sort of a digital platform to send shares of gold around to other people. But the problem with that was that it was a company that mm-hmm. had to hold the gold somewhere. And so if it gets too big, you know, the government could just shut it down, which is exactly what happened with eGold. So realizing that Bitcoin couldn't be shut down and that it did not have any counterparty risk, meaning it didn't rely on any one person or company, that really made it stand out as something that was extremely powerful and absolutely unprecedented.
Sure, that makes sense. And sorry, I interrupted you as we were starting to talk about some of the initial projects you were involved in.
Yeah, so probably for the first 9 months after I got interested, I had dropped all the responsible things I was doing in my normal life. At the time, I was working in freelance, you know, marketing and brand development work, mm-hmm. trying to figure out what I wanted to do with my future. And just kind of threw all that aside and dove in. I didn't know if a career could come out of it or not, but it was something I was passionate about. So in mid-2012, I joined BitInstant, which was the first really successful early crypto company. And that was in New York. So I moved down to New York from New Hampshire. I was the head of marketing at BitInstant. And around that same time, I started a side project called Satoshi Dice, which was a Bitcoin gambling site. Basically, you would send Bitcoin in and the system would do a roll of the dice. And if you lost, it would send you a trace amount back to let you know that. And if you won, it would send you a lot more Bitcoin back. And that absolutely took off and became quite an amazing phenomenon. In 2012 and 2013, it was more than half of all the Bitcoin transactions in the world were just to and from that site. And by then I was starting to get fairly well known within the crypto world, and I'm fairly outspoken about my political ideologies. And I came to the conclusion that I could either be, you know, a prominent figure in Bitcoin, or I could run a Bitcoin casino, but not both, because doing both was too dangerous, really. Would make me too much of a target. So sold Satoshi Dice. BitInstant had a big falling out, which I won't get into now, but I moved down to Panama for a year, and I was running a crypto wallet company called Coinapult for about a year. Decided that wasn't the right fit for me and left that, and started Shapeshift, which is what I still run today. So I'm founder and CEO of Shapeshift, which is a digital asset exchange, which is about 4 years old at this point.
You've got a lot of interesting experiences along the way in different facets of the space. Maybe touching on the political side and then jump into the exchange. What is your take, acknowledging that it's extremely hard to, you know, predict more than a couple of years out? How do you see crypto interacting with established institutions, governments, 10 years from now, 20 years from now, or maybe a couple of different cases that you think are realistic?
Yeah, so that's always my favorite topic, because I think it delves into philosophy, ethics, monetary policy, economics. And really the, you know, ascent of technology generally.
Mm-hmm.
But basically, you know, my belief and hope from the first days I got interested in this stuff was that Bitcoin would become a credible rival to fiat currencies like the dollar and the euro, and that over time it would outcompete fiat currencies in the marketplace. And people would realize, you know, more and more at the margins that holding their money in a form of currency that was debased by governments every year, in which they lost 2 or 3% of the value, essentially through the theft of inflation, that was maybe not ideal, and that now that there was an alternative, they would increasingly move to Bitcoin or other cryptocurrencies as a much more fair and open and transparent and honest form of currency than what they had used with government money.
One counter that I would be curious to get your opinion on, how do you think about the current role of central banks in financial crises? So, you know, one useful function that, you know, you could be argued they serve as a lender of last resort, stepping in with quantitative easing in the event of economic shocks. And perhaps a counter to that counter is some of those collapses or fallouts are at least partially caused, and it's hard to, you know, quantify the impact by easy money policies. You know, the easy money policy following the dot-com cycle that drove rates down and created incentives to get into, you know, for instance, risky mortgage lending.
Yeah. So probably first, it's important to understand that central banks have not been a part of humanity forever.
Mm-hmm.
The U.S. Central Bank, the Federal Reserve, was created in 1913. And prior to 1913, obviously the United States grew tremendously fast, you know, from its agrarian roots through the entire Industrial Revolution. So somehow, you know, the greatest advance of, you know, poverty alleviation and human standard of living that had ever happened in the world occurred without central banks.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that's an important point. The Federal Reserve was then created in 1913 in order to, quote unquote, stabilize the financial system and stabilize the purchasing power of the dollar, which is funny because the purchasing power of the dollar had been quite stable since the founding of the country up until 1913. It cost roughly the same amount to buy a loaf of bread at the revolution than it did in the year 1900. But then the Federal Reserve was created, and subsequently the dollar has lost, you know, 98% of its value since then. So the phenomenon that people live under today, where prices rise every year, things get more and more expensive, I think a lot of people just assume that's kind of a force of nature, in a market that is what happens. And it's really quite tragic. I mean, the reason that happens is because there's a central bank that prints more and more money every year. And so it's not that those things are getting more expensive. It's that the value of the currency is falling. And I think that's really the greatest, most horrible financial fraud and scam that's ever been perpetrated on humanity. Mm-hmm. And cryptocurrency, if it does anything important, might help show the world that that's going on. So that's really my ultimate goal with this stuff, is for the world to be able to use a honest money, mm-hmm. a market-based money, as opposed to a coercive government-based money.
What do you think are some of the biggest existential threats that would prevent cryptocurrencies, whether that be Bitcoin or another alternative or a combination of alternatives, from reaching that kind of mass adoption that would be necessary to supplant the existing systems?
Yeah, I mean, from the start, I've always tried to have my assumption be that crypto would fail, that mm-hmm. some horrible thing would happen. Maybe some terrible bug was discovered that meant blockchains didn't actually work. Or, maybe every government in the world just clamps down completely and snuffs it out. Something, but assume that it wouldn't work. it is experimental and new, but each day and each year that goes by, it's getting increasingly powerful and increasingly widespread.
Mm-hmm.
So I would say that its dominance of global monetary systems is not inevitable. But if some sort of cataclysmic problem doesn't happen, then I can't see how people will prefer to hold money in a depreciating currency rather than one that is limited in supply. I think the biggest threats to Bitcoin are other cryptocurrencies. So, but that would be fine. I mean, the promise of cryptocurrency would still be fulfilled if it was a different one other than Bitcoin. But the threats to cryptocurrency generally, I think, are largely some kind of technical problem that hasn't really been discovered yet, but the likelihood of that is less and less with each day. Or governments just completely freaking out and trying to, destroy everyone who's involved. Whether they would be successful, I don't think so. They've been quite unsuccessful at banning, anything else, such as drugs. And crypto is much easier to send across a border than a pound of cocaine.
Yeah.
So, it's going to be a really interesting thing to watch and witness over the next 10 or 20 years.
Absolutely. It has been for the last, almost decade now.
Yep.
Although, the majority of eyeballs have only fallen on in the last 2 years.
Yep.
So if I'm getting my history right, you used to be more of a Bitcoin advocate over
maximalist.
Yeah. And I think since you've transitioned to a broader mindset, how do you see the crypto asset space evolving over the next couple of years? And to further add some meat to that, the realm of cryptocurrencies, that are largely intended for exchange and store of value and use as a measure of value. And then some of your more comprehensive, if you want to use that word, crypto utilities.
Yeah, so when I first got involved, cryptocurrency was synonymous with Bitcoin and with blockchains. Really, Bitcoin was meant to be a cryptocurrency. It was meant to be a form of payment. And
yep.
I think most people in the early days, that was sort of what they saw. And it wasn't until later that people started realizing that blockchains had larger applications and that lots of different types of tokens or assets could be created on top of these blockchains. Some of them to be used for currencies, but many of them to be used for entirely new and different kinds of things. And so as I started to understand that, I left behind my early Bitcoin maximalism, thinking that Bitcoin mm-hmm. was the dominant cryptocurrency and that everything else was a waste of time. And I came to be much more bullish on the ecosystem of all the different digital assets, and realizing that was actually an important part of the decentralization that Bitcoin espoused. you know, as decentralized as one cryptocurrency can be, if there's an entire universe of different digital assets for all different types of purposes and built in different ways, that is far more resilient and far more decentralized. So I think that's a really important point. And unfortunately, I think there's still a lot of people that refuse to be open-minded to the idea that other digital assets might be useful.
Yep.
And that's often blinded them in a sort of tribalist or religious type fever.
Yeah. And you were very involved, if I'm not mistaken, in advocating for SegWit and an increase in block size for Bitcoin.
Yep.
Or earlier this year. How did that process and the government issues that came to light, you know, like your ability to resolve conflicts or differing opinions about technology in a decentralized organization, how did that affect your perspective on Bitcoin, on altcoins, on governance alternatives that may make one coin more resilient than others?
Yeah, great question. So while I'm very much open to lots of different digital assets and cryptocurrencies existing, my heart and soul are still very much with Bitcoin. And I think it's really important for the entire project for Bitcoin to remain in the dominant position that it's had, because it has mm-hmm. the brand recognition and it's the most tried and tested and the most secure.
Yep.
So I really want Bitcoin to continue to be competitive. And, you know, at the same time, I realize that this stuff is ultimately worthless unless it's useful for something or for many
yep.
things. And, one of Bitcoin's primary uses, at least historically, has been as a means of payment for buying things online, for transferring value from one person to another. You know, in the white paper, it's referred to as a peer-to-peer cash system.
Mm-hmm.
And unfortunately, the fees on the Bitcoin network had gotten so prohibitive up through the end of last year that, you know, when I got involved, it was, you know, less than a penny to send a Bitcoin transaction. And
yep.
At the peak, there were transactions costing, you know, $50 on average to
yep.
send, which excluded a whole swath of different use cases from Bitcoin. And I felt like that was really dangerous. So a lot of people were squabbling about what to do about that, what kind of changes to the protocol to make, if any. And I tried to be fairly pragmatic and say, look, anything that will help address the issue should be considered. And so there were proposals like SegWit that I was very much in favor of and sounded great. I also thought it made sense to increase the size of the Bitcoin block to help alleviate that pressure while other solutions were built out. But for whatever reason, in the Bitcoin community, people started getting very tribalistic about their preferred solution to the exclusion
mm-hmm.
of others. And it really got pretty nasty to the point where the entire Bitcoin community splintered into two or three different factions. And that ultimately caused a couple different hard forks in Bitcoin itself. So now there's Bitcoin Cash, which is an entirely different cryptocurrency and is largely supported by people who really disagreed with the roadmap that Bitcoin was taking. And so much time and mental energy and money was wasted on these debates. And it was really, you know, a painful couple of years. You know, most of 2015, 2016, and 2017 was all wrapped up in this issue.
Mm-hmm.
And it didn't really have a great outcome. It just led to a splintering of a community that used to be very much on the same team about building, you know, cryptocurrency as a alternative to fiat currency. Now became, you know, red team versus blue team. So it was really quite depressing and taught me a lot, I think, about tribalism generally, the same kind of thing you see with sports teams and religions and in politics.
Politics in the U.S., absolutely.
Yeah.
What can communities do differently, or maybe what experimentations are you seeing in other communities that you think could mitigate some of that, acknowledging that, you know, it's really hard to dream up some type of system in a decentralized, by definition, platform?
I'm not sure. I think the issue was one of of human instinct and something
yeah.
really fundamental to human nature,
yeah.
not something endemic to a certain blockchain or a certain organization, but just
mm-hmm.
endemic to people. And
sure.
I don't know that that can get changed other than, you know, every person trying to improve their own character and to become more civil and more open to other ideas, which is a big ask.
Yeah.
So I don't really have a good answer.
Yeah,
no,
on a similar plane, a lot of regulatory agencies have recently been making reference to the creation of some type of self-governing organization. You know, it's like analogous to a FINRA security industry in the United States.
Mm-hmm.
What are your thoughts on that? And I imagine that it's largely going to be geared around people who are leveraging the hype around blockchain and crypto to perpetuate scams that are consistent with, you know, what's been done in all forms of new and fast-growing markets.
Yeah, so there's a couple pieces here. One, I think, I mean, I'm generally a fan of rules, but
mm-hmm.
not a fan of coercive rules imposed by a monopoly rulemaker, such as a government.
Yep.
And so the idea of a industry-based, you know, self-regulatory organization, I think, is far superior to some horrible bureaucracy from the U.S. federal government trying to do it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, on this topic of scams, people always kind of refer to scams and fraud as the justification for more regulations. But scams and fraud are just flat-out illegal already.
Yep.
So I don't know what kind of regulation you need.
Yeah,
when the
it's an enforcement issue.
Flat out illegal. Yeah.
It's an enforcement issue more so than a legislative issue.
Right, right. If there's someone out there defrauding people or stealing or lying,
yeah.
Go after them criminally. That's illegal.
Yep.
I mean, that's the ultimate regulation, right?
Yep.
So, you know, but regulators like to hearken back to that as a reason that they need more powers to issue more rules. And usually their rules are not against fraudsters because, again, that's already illegal. They're against the people that are actually trying to build things honestly.
Mm-hmm.
They think that they can centrally design and plan how an industry should work. And I get, you know, that's all they know. That's all they understand as regulators. They don't build things. They only know how to issue proclamations and write down rules that others have to follow.
Yep.
So that's just kind of in their nature. But I would much prefer to see an industry-based self-regulatory organization.
Yeah. On the subject of countries trying to come up with central solutions, what's your take on Hetero and some of these other government-led crypto concepts that are coming to market?
Yeah. So you're referring to the Petro?
Exactly.
I would call it
Venezuela.
PR. Marketing campaign from Nicolas Maduro for Venezuela, basically saying we're going to issue a cryptocurrency backed by oil. The problem with any cryptocurrency that is backed is that its entire value relies on the trustworthiness of the backer.
Yep.
This is one of the main reasons why Bitcoin was so revolutionary and important was that it didn't have a backer. It wasn't anyone else's responsibility or liability. I think there's a good place for some commodity-backed cryptocurrencies, but never would I own one that is backed by one of the least trustworthy entities in the world. And it's just amazing that government, after all the financial chaos that they've caused, has the cojones to go out and say, all right, look, we've lied pretty much about everything. Our economy is in ruins. But buy our cryptocurrency, and we promise that it will be backed with the oil that we've no longer even been able to extract.
What's even more incredible is that they somehow found people to invest in it.
Well, I'm not sure of that, actually. So I read an article about this guy who's trying to figure out, you know, to what extent people have actually participated in this. And he was looking at the actual smart contracts on Ethereum where the Petro token was created. He found there was no movement of these coins, so they were not being sent to anyone who was buying them.
Mm-hmm.
And when he tried to buy some, he tried to sign up and go through the process, all he got was a buggy website that basically let him state an amount that he wanted to buy, and then no follow up. Like, so I'm not sure that anyone's actually bought any of it. There's maybe some parties that have expressed interest, but the whole thing is just totally scammy. And, it's just one of those dramatic stories in the crypto industry that keeps popping up. And it's, you know, there's never a dull day in this market.
Someone has to keep it interesting.
Yeah. Well, you know, imagine if like 5 or 6 years ago, when people in the crypto world were debating on the internet about like how things would unfold, and someone suggested that, you know, Nicolas Maduro would be creating an oil-backed cryptocurrency in the year 2018. That would sound so silly and stupid, and yet it happened.
Only cryptocurrency.
Yep.
Maybe touching a little bit on Shapeshift, so shifting to, you know, industry participation, how do you view the role of centralized exchanges going forward? The fragmentation, the evolution of major players, some that are more consumer-facing, some that are more geared toward altcoins, how you think about Shapeshift strategy, and then some other solutions aside from exchanges like atomic swaps that are starting to be implemented.
Yeah, so in the crypto world, there's always been this tension or irony, I guess, between the fact that the coins and the blockchains are decentralized, but the main entry and exit points and the main markets for this stuff have been centralized.
Yep.
And many observers have pointed out that that's problematic, and I think in some ways it is. The problem, however, with centralized exchanges, I think, is not that there's an entity providing a service which is centralized. The problem is with the risk, the financial risk to the users. So Mt. Gox was the ultimate example of this, where they lost, you know, $400 million, and a whole bunch of people, you know, just lost everything that they had been storing there. That's the risk. And it's really sad when you have this technology that allows people to not have to trust any other party, and yet they still end up doing it and then lose all their money with that. So, and there are obviously many exchanges that operate in that way. They're, you know, probably a lot more honest and reliable than Mt. Gox, but the point remains there have been, you know, every few months there's a big hacking of some exchange somewhere.
Yep.
So, you know, when I built Shapeshift, I wanted to avoid that big risk, which meant avoiding a structure in which we had to hold the deposits of all of our customers. So Shapeshift works differently in that someone sends in one kind of digital asset like Bitcoin, and we send them immediately out the other kinds that they're trying to buy, like Ethereum. So they do sort of have to trust us, I guess, for the period of the transaction, but that's a couple minutes as opposed to leaving funds with us, you know, over weeks or months. And what it means is that at any given time, the amount of customer funds that we have exposed to us is de minimis. It's irrelevant. And I think that was a really important innovation to build, basically, you know, allowing people to trade with a service that was there and it was liquid and had customer support and was easy to use, but didn't have a model that was endangering everyone with hundreds of millions of dollars of counterparty risk.
So the whole custody aspect of holding and using on a daily basis cryptocurrencies, it's difficult for the average end user, especially when you start looking across the generations, you know, those that are less tech savvy or, you know, are just wrapping their minds around the concepts altogether. How do you see custody solutions and wallets going forward? I find it hard to imagine a future in which you don't have centralized organizations that at the very least providing custody solutions. And if I'm not mistaken, you've recently become involved with KeepKey and are trying to integrate that with Shapeshift. So I imagine you're thinking a lot about that component as well.
Yeah. So there are some people in the crypto industry that want everything to be perfectly decentralized in every way all the time.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's really silly and unhelpful. There are a lot of good reasons for things centralized in certain ways. But the beauty of the crypto economy is that there are options, and it's a market. People can try different models, and users and consumers that all have different tastes and preferences can find those services that they prefer. You know, a grandmother that's getting interested in Bitcoin because her grandchild told her about it at Thanksgiving dinner, you know, she should probably not be setting up her own private keys somewhere. Coinbase is an awesome solution for her, where she can just hold it in a custodial account with Coinbase. They take care of all the security for her, and that's a great model. On the other hand, once she becomes an expert in this stuff and she's like, wow, this is way better than dollars, I don't want to use that stupid banking system anymore, become proficient with this, she has the option to move her crypto out of a company like Coinbase and store it, in her own wallet somewhere or on a hardware device or in a multi-sig account. There are just many different options for her. And so that kind of dynamism, I think, is really great, allowing everyone to use a different kind of service that suits their needs and preferences.
Yeah, that totally makes sense. How do you see 2018 unfolding in terms of mass adoption, access, turning over into the hands of more people? I mean, Robinhood, for instance, mm-hmm. unveiling a host of cryptocurrencies. At what point or how long do you think it will take for cryptocurrencies to be less of a speculative tool, highly volatile and mostly geared around people who are using them as a store of value, hesitant to use them in payments now for fear of future price appreciation, and that impacts in the near term a couple of trends that you see shaping up in 2018?
It's probably important to understand that all of these assets, Bitcoin is the first one, and then all the other different digital assets that have occurred, when they start out, they're essentially 100% speculation. Everyone
yep.
buying them thinks that there might be a potential use of them in the future. And then over time, they either start finding some of that real use, which justifies the speculation that happened before, or they don't, in which case the speculators start losing money. Bitcoin, in 2009 or 10, you couldn't really use it for anything. And I think it would be fair to say it was 100 or 99% speculation. Over time, that percentage has fallen. There are millions of people that are using Bitcoin for real world things. Not many that use it exclusively, and it's still not the best option for lots of different kinds of uses. But people are finding an increasing number of places where it makes sense. A lot of international remittance, a way to hold value in a secure manner that no one else can take from you. So that real utility emerges over time, and if it does emerge, then the justification the speculative justification is valid. But that's something that has to be earned with time. It doesn't just happen from day one. And each other token that's coming out, I think, will follow a similar pattern. Mm-hmm. People that bought Ethereum during its crowd sale, that was 100% speculation. Ethereum is now launched. It works. Smart contracts are awesome. And there are people using it to build actual services and utilities, which helps justify the speculation of, 2 years ago.
What is your personal schematic for thinking about the utility value of a given coin? The most common, be transaction spend, at least in the realm of currencies, and then the fully diluted coin count and the curve over time, however it's defined in the underlying blockchain.
Well, probably each person is going to do this subjectively. So, mm-hmm. What one person finds useful in Bitcoin, sending $100 to their Filipino personal assistant once a month, is not something another person uses at all. But maybe that other person, wants a little more privacy in their payments, so they use Bitcoin on some online websites. Maybe someone really loves to gamble, but they were tired of, 3 month payout times from the casino through the banking system, so they gamble now using crypto casinos instead of fiat casinos. Each of these people and all the others that will come to this stuff have their own kind of subjective preferences. And some people use Bitcoin not as payment at all, but they use it as they use the blockchain to anchor information, in which case payments really aren't part of their calculus.
Mm-hmm.
And it's really, I think impossible to know all the different things that everyone is going to use it for. It's an open platform. And in the same way that in, 1990, I wouldn't have been able to predict many or most of the useful applications of the internet, I don't think I can do that with Bitcoin either.
Sure. What are some of the, or in the case of Bitcoin, features or solutions that are being advanced And in the case of the broader coin universe, different coins that you find particularly interesting right now.
So I love Salt. Salt is a project I've been an advisor.
That's the lending platform, right?
Yeah. Salt is awesome. So basically Salt allows someone to give their crypto to Salt, and Salt will give them a loan in fiat. So there's all these people that have a bunch of crypto wealth at this point, and maybe they want to buy a car or put a down payment on their house or send their kid to college. And to do that, they have to sell their crypto, which is bad, both because they're bullish long term, so they don't want to sell it, and also because when they sell it, it's a tax event. So by simply, you know, giving your crypto to a company that then makes a loan collateralized with the crypto, you avoid both those problems. So Salt is one I'm super bullish on, largely because I want it for myself. I think the privacy coins are really important. So Monero,
Zcash,
yeah. One of the coolest things about this market is that every time some kind of problem or weakness with Bitcoin is revealed or suspected, there's immediately entrepreneurs working on some other solution to it. So right around, 2013, 2014, when people are starting to realize that Bitcoin wasn't really anonymous, other engineers figured out ways to make more anonymous cryptocurrencies. And I think that's really exciting.
I share the enthusiasm for Monero and Zcash as well. Especially as, regulatory bodies start becoming better at identifying and tracing Bitcoin, I could see the demand for a truly anonymous private solution really filling in.
Yeah, and whether those coins have a future forever ahead of them or whether their technology somehow gets rolled into Bitcoin is almost immaterial. The point is that kind of experimentation is happening and the solutions are available for people. I also think, chains like Litecoin or even Bitcoin Cash that have more capacity for on-chain transactions, I think that's important. It should always be possible to send $2 of crypto to someone for a payment. And Bitcoin fees have gone drastically down since December, so it's much better now. But if that problem rears its head again, it's good that there are alternatives that have different models and different structures to be able to provide for those use cases. And then Ethereum has to be said to be by far the second best blockchain or arguably the best in some ways. Bitcoin and Ethereum, I think, are really powerful allies and complements. And I can see a future in which both of them have really good success.
This is a really good conversation. Is there anything else that's top of mind for you or that you've been thinking a lot about recently or have been hearing a lot about that we didn't cover?
I should probably mention ICOs and token sales generally.
Mm-hmm.
That was really the phenomenon of 2017.
Yep.
I think it's an incredible phenomenon. I mean, basically the ability for a project or a person to raise capital with very little friction from people all over the world very quickly is really, really powerful. And with any powerful tool, there will be people that misuse it and people that are not as careful as they should be. But, the fact remains that now that someone can raise $50 million on a good idea, that's going to change how the world works. That was not possible to do before token sales. And VCs, as much as they like to say that they are innovators and always on the cutting edge, they often will simply follow the herd. So someone with truly unique ideas that doesn't fit into the traditional mold that a VC would look for, they now have a funding mechanism. Some 15-year-old kid in sub-Saharan Africa, if he knows what he's doing and he has a great idea, he can potentially raise $50 million now. That's quite incredible, and I think is going to really have some profound implications for the world over the next couple decades.
Yeah. How do you see that interfacing with traditional is not the right word, but other crowdfunding mechanisms that are, equity-based? Not every type of company, deserves a coin, or I should say, is a coin appropriate for?
Yeah, I mean, I think more and more things are going to become tokenized, so including equity itself. I think 10 or 20 years from now, when you have shares of Apple, it's going to be a crypto token that exists on a blockchain. And there are a number of reasons why I think that kind of thing will happen. But anyone who's doing funding where the person paying in gets something, either a right in their product or a dividend stream or even just recognition of the event, tokens can work really well. I don't think token sales will replace or remove every other kind of funding, but I think they're actually going to find quite a wide variety of applications.
Interesting. Cool. Well, Eric, thanks again for joining us.
Yeah. Great question. Thanks.